Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. Later this hour, Governor Gavin Newsom talks about his homelessness task force. Massive task it is, and we'll talk about that with him. But first, in the wake of State Senate Bill SB 50 shelving, there's a lot of rancor. The bill would have overridden local zoning restrictions against higher density construction along transit corridors. Much of residential Southern California would have been affected. Residents of those single-family homes argued their quality of life would suffer from worse traffic, lack of parking, and greater transiency. Preservationists were also concerned that historic concentrations of homes would be lost. But advocates for a denser, more Manhattan-like or San Francisco-style city see the resistance as hypocritical and elitist, particularly in a Democratic-dominant region like ours. This view is encapsulated in a New York Times op-ed this morning from our frequent Air Talk guest, Farhad Manju, titled "America's Cities Are Unlivable, Blame Wealthy Liberals." Farhad writes, "Creating dense, economically and socially diverse urban environments ought to be a paramount goal of progressivism. Cities are the standard geographical unit of the global economy. Dense urban areas are quite literally the real America." That's Farhad Manju in his New York Times op-ed today. And unfortunately, Farhad couldn't join us today, but I'd like to hear what you think of that premise. Is it inconsistent to hold progressive views and at the same time favor less dense, historic single-family neighborhoods? We're at 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722, or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. With me is Joel Kotkin, Presidential Fellow in Urban Futures at Chapman University in Orange, and Executive Director of the Center for Opportunity Urbanism, a Houston-based think tank. He's also author of The Human City, Urbanism for the Rest of Us. He also contributes op-ed pieces to the SoCal News Group. Joel, good to have you with us again.
Oh, it's nice to be here.
So your thoughts about Farhad's contention that to be truly progressive, the city, the dense urban space is the logical and consistent expression of that.
Well, that article had so much garbage in it. It was, you know, they ought to take it out to the ocean. First of all, when he talks about dense urban areas being the drivers of the economy, we have to remember there's something called geography. Most American jobs aren't located in dense urban cores. They're located in suburbs. About 80% both jobs and population. So that contention is sort of wrong. The second thing is, the opposition to SB 50 was pretty broad. It wasn't just a bunch of rich people in Brentwood. It was really, a lot of it was in places like South LA. And I know because I've actually spoken to the people, South LA, East LA, areas that felt that they would be greatly threatened. The bigger issue, I think, in many ways is that, well, there are two big issues. One, we really need to be looking at what kind of housing we are building. If you're building, what we're building now when we build the density, we've been building lots of density, we're building studio one-bedroom apartments that are expensive. I don't know what problem that solves, but it certainly doesn't do much. The reality is our problem in California is we're losing our middle class and we're losing families. L.A. had the biggest drop in the number of children of any metro in the United States, big metro in the U.S. So, you know, building larger units, whether it's single-family houses or townhouses, seems to be what we really need. We don't need a lot of, you know, little units for, you know, hipsters who are going to live in them for a year and then move. The other thing is there are enormous opportunities to build housing in our cities and in our suburbs, one obviously on the periphery, but also we're going to have this enormous tsunami of redundant retail space, strip malls that are not in anyone's neighborhood, already have the infrastructure, and are going to be redundant and where we can be building housing. This is starting to happen already. That's something that we should have a policy from the state to encourage localities to allow for housing to be built in those places. And then in the study we just did at the Center for Opportunity Urbanism, we found in Chicago, Dallas, and L.A., large tracts of undeveloped abandoned land, again, where we could build things. We don't have to go into middle and working class neighborhoods and essentially transform them into places of dense, expensive housing. I don't see where that's progressive, but you know, then again, I don't call myself a progressive either.
All right. Joel Kotkin with us, Chapman University, the Center for Opportunity Urbanism, contributes weekly op-eds to the SoCal News Group as well. Again, I'd like to hear from you what you think about Farhad Manjoo's piece in today's New York Times, in which he argues that the sort of ultimate expression of progressivism is with highly dense urban areas, that's much more egalitarian, that's the ideal way that we live, the carrying capacity is left less, it's environmentally friendly. What do you think about that? Is it possible to be a progressive and not hold that as the ideal vision? 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Also with us from the Luskin School of Public Affairs at UCLA, research professor Paul Ong. He's the director of the Center for Neighborhood Knowledge at UCLA as well. Professor, thank you for being with us.
Thank you. Good morning, Larry.
So do you think that Farhad has it right that it's inconsistent to fight the higher density expansion into historic single-family neighborhoods and be a progressive?
I think there's a huge problem. I think you could be a progressive, but you have to be a progressive that's committed to making the kind of sacrifice that's needed to make the transition. I think part of the problem is everybody is approaching this looking for the perfect solution, and that has become the enemy of the good in terms of moving forward. Clearly, I agree with many of the comments earlier. The transition in terms of any change can be detrimental to neighborhoods such as South LA. So one of the limitations of legislation is that I think it needs more attention in terms of protection of renters' protections. In terms of during the transition, how do we make the benefits benefit everyone? I think there's also another problem is that although we are increasing the supply of housing, it's not adequate. If you only have marginal increase in supply, it's going to stay with those with the greatest demand and greatest income. And there's very little trickle down. There's lots of latent demand, for example, where I'm living temporarily now in San Francisco, lots of latent demand for our high earners, high income. So if you only have a limited supply, new supply, it's not going to deal with our housing crisis. I do agree with the argument that given climate change and California's initiative to deal with climate change, we need to have the opportunity to move to denser, more efficient urban development. The legislation doesn't force that. What it is doing is allowing that to happen by getting rid of the NIMBYism barriers that we've been facing. We inherited a zoning regimen from decades, if not centuries ago. What's appropriate back then is certainly not appropriate today.
Well, I think some of these communities, though, have had quite recent neighborhood plans that have been put together for the kind of character that they're looking for, the mix of retail to commercial to residential. So I understand that, you know, some of these might not have redone their plans for a long time, but other of these neighborhoods have fairly regularly come back and looked at those plans. I want to hear from residents. We're at 866-893-KPECC. Mark in Woodland Hills. This is an issue certainly in your community. What do you think?
Yes, I live in Woodland Hills, and we actually had a meeting of the Woodland Hills Homeowners Association last night and spoke about this directly. To the question of whether or not the plans have been updated, Woodland Hills does have a new plan. It was ratified, and they're in the middle of building a new city center now. They call it Woodland Hills 2035. That is going to be high density. There are several buildings that are going up now. I live in a single-family home in Woodland Hills, and I believe that it should be my right to live in such a place. I chose to live there rather than downtown Los Angeles or New York or San Francisco because of the character, because of the feel, because of the energy of that place. And I don't think that the state should force me to watch high density go up across the street from me just because it can.
Mark, let me ask you, do you consider yourself a political progressive or someone who's more moderate or conservative?
I do consider myself to be a progressive. I don't agree with all of the tenets of the progressive platform. I don't think there's okay. really one group that I would identify with 100%.
So the argument that Farhad Manjoo puts forth in today's New York Times is the argument that essentially the life that you chose in purchasing your home, a particular kind of single family neighborhood, that really that's not consistent with progressive values, that environmentally, transportationally, in providing access to people to have more affordable housing, that really in the long run is not sustainable, that it is the dense urban model that is the way that we should all live to be consistent with progressivism. Your response to that?
I don't think that one precludes the other. I think part of the reason that we enjoy life here in the United States is that we have choice. And I think that some of the arguments that say, well, we're running out of space. We're not running out of space, not by any stretch of the imagination. We may be running out of space in already developed areas. But this idea of even the huge complexes that are being built in my area, these are not going to be available to the average person.
All right, Mark, I appreciate it very much. Let me go back to Paul Ong of UCLA's Luskin School of Public Affairs. So how do you get this sort of, you know, more egalitarian, different income levels are housed that Farhad writes about in his piece? Because when I look at Manhattan, when I look at San Francisco, these are among the most expensive cities in the world, despite having the high density. So how do you get to what Farhad describes?
I think an egalitarian front. I do respect the fact that single-family homeowners have a right to choice and have a right to try to pursue their lifestyle. I think what we need to do is balance that off, that those who with more limited income, limited means, they should also have the right to pursue housing, affordable housing. And it's how you balance that. If we have artificial restrictions on the ability to supply housing, particularly at the low end, then we're not egalitarian. We're not providing the same set of opportunities to pursue people's dreams and so forth. And again, if you're a low-wage worker and so forth, we have a system of zoning. We have a system of restrictions. We have NIMBYism that makes it very difficult to give the same set of opportunities. I would prefer to get rid of some of the restrictions and to see if we could supply through market means and also through state support for affordable housing, that we give the options to those who could least afford it.
Okay.
So is density equity? It's partially. It's not the full answer, but certainly.
But it takes us further on that road, as you see it.
Yeah.
Paul Ong, UCLA Luskin School of Public Affairs, Professor Joel Kotkin of Chapman University and the Center for Opportunity Urbanism. Joel, your response to what Paul was just saying.
Well, I agree with some of what Paul's saying, but I think that first of all, when we've done the studies on inequality, core cities, the more dense areas have much greater inequality than the suburbs and the exurbs. I think, what we're doing is we're really should start thinking about places like the Inland Empire, which is the one area that's growing. LA County, of course, is losing population now. And how do we accommodate the aspirations, not just of the lower income people, which I think Paul addresses, but also the aspirations of upwardly mobile people who would like to buy a house, particularly young people who, you know, at this stage, the chance of them buying in most of Los Angeles and certainly most of Orange County is pretty negligible. So we have to start thinking about how we can create all sorts of different kinds of development, particularly in places like the Inland Empire, which are very much demographically vibrant. And we also have to start thinking again about all the opportunities that exist inside our cities, land that's not being used, land that's redundant, retail. We're not even addressing those opportunities. And the idea of going in and saying that here's your single family neighborhood and now speculators can come in and do whatever they want, well, that's kind of a violation, I think, of people's expectations and why you bought the house in the first place. And so, I mean, if you bought a single family house, like I do a lot of work in Houston, which doesn't have zoning, they have covenants where, you know, certain areas are controlled, and you can't build certain kinds of housing. But in other areas, people buy houses in areas which are zoned that they can go pretty much as dense as they want, and you buy that house for a different reason. You buy it more for speculative purposes. What worries me are the sociological impacts of going in and ruining stable, middle, and working-class neighborhoods on the one hand. And on the other hand, I agree that there has to be more housing options, and particularly for working-class people. The problem is going to be that right now construction of such housing is so expensive that there may not be enough money to make it happen. I don't think it's – when you talk to the market-rate people, very few of them think that there's going to be a great market opportunity in building apartments for poor people. So, you know, how we do that, I really think is, you know, something that we ought to be thinking about, as opposed to building a bunch of expensive units in Brentwood that will be used by yuppies. I mean, solving any problems.
Let me reset where we're at for those who've just tuned in. If you're just with us, we're talking about a piece in today's New York Times by frequent Air Talk guest. He's an op-ed writer for the Times, Farhad Manju, where he takes direct aim at progressives who fought SB 50, which was billed in Sacramento, died last week in committee. It would have allowed for development of higher density structures in areas otherwise zoned for less dense single-family homes and the like. And Farhad, in his piece titled America's Cities Are Unlivable, Blame Wealthy Liberals, he says that creating dense, economically, socially diverse urban environments ought to be a paramount goal of progressivism. Cities are the standard geographical unit of the global economy. Dense urban areas are quite literally the real America. So he's advocating that to be consistent with progressive values, that a city like Los Angeles, for example, really needs to remake itself in a much more dense environment in sort of the days of the single family home with a front and backyard, that those days are really done environmentally, economically, and in terms of equity. So my question for you is, do you endorse that premise that Farhad writes about today or not? 866-893-KPECC. Katie in Toluca Lake, I understand this is hitting quite close to home for you.
Hi, yeah, thanks for having me on. In our neighborhood, all of our like four-unit 1950s little apartment buildings are being destroyed to put up these big condos, which now we can't afford. I'm a senior. And, you know, these little units are rent controlled. So we are all getting displaced and there's nowhere for us to go, not only because the rents have increased so dramatically, but, you know, they're not putting us back in these condos that they built at affordable prices.
And you're in an area that already allows this under zoning laws.
Yeah, it's horrible. It's up and down every street, and there's, you know, literally seniors out on the street with their bags going, now what?
Professor Paul Long, how do you create more units, denser housing, and protect the gates?
I think those are not necessarily mutually exclusive goals. I think one of the problems is with any policy is implementation. And certainly for SB 50, I would like to see much more protection for our existing tenants. I think there is always a problem in our market economy during transition is that it moves towards those who are more privileged and have higher income. And it displaces people and it hurts people who don't have either the political or economic means in terms of achieving their own goal. So as we make this transition, and I do truly believe we have to have the opportunity to make the transition. Legislation is not about forcing the transition. It's about giving the opportunity to make that transition to denser development. That as we move in that direction, we got to be mindful of the fact that it quite often, if left to its own forces, hurts people. And so I would like to see as we move in that direction in terms of legislation and policy, not only a policy that increases the opportunity and potential for densification and other efficient development,
I guess
that we be mindful of protecting people at the same time.
I guess the question is, how do you do that short of the state of California saying we're going to pay the rents for people, which I don't think we're going to see legislation to that effect. So unless you're in some way going to subsidize people's rents, how would you do this if there's not the economics for developers to build low income housing?
Well, part of it is part of the legislation is how do you grant development rights and provide us incentives at the same time, you know, take advantage of the additional incentives, the additional economic gains, and redistribute it in terms of developing affordable housing. And developing affordable housing doesn't necessarily have to be a new one. It's also you could use those sort of resources in terms of additional development, additional incentives to developers to protect existing units or help people transition from existing affordable units into new affordable units. So if the legislation is about opening up opportunities for development, and in doing so, how do we take advantage of that additional development in terms of shifting some of the benefits in terms of additional finances and so forth to protect affordable housing? There's lots of details that's going to need to be worked out.
All right. Let me bring into the conversation Monica joining us from Crenshaw Manor in Southwest L.A. Monica, how do you see it?
Hi, Larry. I really take issue with the Times article. And I think, like so many things, we take a concern that people on the left, progressives, care about legitimately affordable housing. And a solution gets proposed that serves every interest but those who would be most affected. So what I think is happening in this case, that developers get carte blanche to build where they want to build, and the units that they build will not be affordable. It's very clear that we have vacancy rates now at 45% in luxury housing. So the key to this is to create housing for people who can't afford it. As a single family homeowner in Crenshaw Manor, this home has been in our family for four generations. We're not going to solve the housing, affordable housing shortage. Again, it's not a housing shortage. It's affordable housing. We're not going to solve that by building multi-family units next door to my single family home and making my neighborhood untenable.
Monica, I appreciate your call. Monica in Crenshaw Manor, we're at 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Harrison in Riverside says, I have two twins and a little boy. My wife and I are moving to Michigan. We just can't afford a house here. Everything is more affordable in Michigan. Sherwin in Culver City says, the city is so densely possible, it's almost impossible to move around, especially with the lack of public transit. This is supposed to be a non-city city, and we're turning into New York. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Brian, with us in Hollywood, where, of course, this issue is at the center of the community. Brian, your thoughts?
My thoughts are, at the same time SB 50 was going through and stopped, was stalled in the appropriations, AB 724, which you talked about on the show and I learned about on the show, AB 724 was also held up. AB 724 would have collected the data that we need to know if the behaviors of people and housing is moving forward. One of the things that really kind of gets my goat is that a lot of this urban planning and density was done before the smartphone came into effect. So a lot of housing stock, Airbnb, real estate investment trusts, et cetera, were all subsequent to this kind of planning. And if it's for climate change that is pushing it and density, we just got reports that the air is cleaner in our area. We've also gotten reports that the population is not increasing in Southern California. And we got reports that those who got pushed out of their homes are actually buying older cars, which is actually polluting more and adding in. So my question is, why cannot we get actually data that works together to really paint the picture of the needed housing?
Yeah, it's a great, great question, Brian. Thanks so much. Let's hold that for right now. We'll come back and continue the conversation. We have so many listeners who want to weigh in on this issue. But right now, I'm joined by Governor Gavin Newsom, who this week announced the formation of task forces to deal with homelessness. Mental health issues have also been a prime concern related to homelessness and otherwise. Mayor Newsom, good to have you with us again.
Nice to be with you.
So let's talk about the new task force that you're putting together, featuring County Supervisor Mark Ridley Thomas, along with former Sacramento Mayor and former Senate President Pro Tem Daryl Steinberg. What is their charge going forward?
Well, one thing is self-evident. California has been nowhere to be found as a state as it relates to the issue of homelessness. There's no overriding statewide strategy, statewide plan to deal with what's going on in the streets and sidewalks all throughout the state. That needs to change. So this is an advisory committee made up of folks that are on the front lines, folks that are out there struggling every single day at the local level to try to solve this problem. We have not only tasked them with sharing best practices in real time, but moreover, we are providing over $1 billion of additional resources for cities and counties, large and small, all over the state, to address this issue head on.
Where is the mental health piece of this? Because you got some folks who say we'll lead with housing for people, others who believe that permanent supportive housing with wraparound services is essential to really change the lives of individuals who've been long-term unhoused. Where do you come down on that?
Well, I come down on this paradigm. Shelters solve sleep, housing and supportive services solves homelessness. But here's the challenge. The last point of time count, which is now 2 years old in 2017, we had 134,278 people out on the streets and sidewalks. That's the highest in the United States, 24% of the nation's homeless. The new numbers are just coming in. You're going to get new ones in Southern California, but Kern County just came back, 64% increase. Alameda up here in Northern California, 43% increase. These numbers are jaw-dropping. It's a disgrace. And so we need some short-term solutions as well. And we're putting in the budget what we call money for navigation centers. It's a more robust shelter. But in addition to that, we're giving resources to focus on rapid rehousing, focusing on jobs, keeping people in their homes with rent subsidies, legal protections, and the like. It is a significant increase of appropriation. A lot of discrepancy in the front for frontline folks, meaning we don't want to be prescriptive from Sacramento. We want people to be able to use the money in a flexible way. But mental health is top of mind, too. We have the former director of the National Institute of Mental Health, Tom Insel, who we just announced as the new mental health czar in California to create a new mental health future for the state. That's his task. And that's a multi-year effort. I don't want to overpromise, but we've never had intentionality on mental health. And that will be integrated substantively in all these conversations.
One of the big challenges, of course, in meeting the mental health needs is just the human power, having the number of trained individuals with the skills and the funding hand in hand. And getting enough people will not be easy, nor is historically getting the funding. Do you have a specific idea, or do you leave this to the task force to come up with a recruitment of counselors to do this kind of work, along with ongoing funds designated for it?
No, it's a great question. So in the budget, I put $150 million to deal with mental health workforce issues. It is a major issue. We simply do not have the trained personnel to address this crisis. And so we're putting, and you know, it may not sound like a lot, it may sound like too much to others, but we think $150 million will go a long way to getting us where we need to go. But look, we need emergency aid out there right away. This is simply out of control. Everywhere you go in the state, this is by no means unique to LA or Southern California or big urban centers. It's the biggest issue out in Fresno and Bakersfield and parts of the central part of the state, northern part of the state. I cannot impress upon folks more that we get it. The question is, are we going to get something done that's meaningful and rational and also done with compassion and civil liberties as well? And that's a framework that's a balance, is how you encourage people with bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, paranoia that are self-medicating with drug or alcohol addictions. How do you encourage them to get off the streets, meet them where they are in a way that does not inure to impeding their civil liberties and their civil rights at the same time?
We're talking with California Governor Gavin Newsom, joining us to talk about his unveiling of a homelessness task force to be co-chaired by Daryl Steinberg, former Senate President pro tem and mayor of Sacramento, which has its own serious problem with homelessness. Mark Ridley Thomas, Los Angeles County Supervisor, has been the point person for the board on this issue locally as well. The task force will then be filled out with other people from throughout California to deal with the crisis. Governor Newsom, this, of course, is statewide. You find it in the Central Valley. You find it in rural coastal areas like Eureka and Arcata. It's throughout the state. But where we see the largest concentrations are in some of the densest urban areas, coastal California, areas where it's very expensive and very difficult to create additional housing for those who can't pay market value. So how can that part of this, even with the funding, address the simple cost per unit of creating that housing?
Well, the time value of money is very important. And so one of the things I included in the budget, and I'm surprised it's not gotten more attention, is to address some of the abuses we're seeing with folks that are just not willing to do their part with respect to community members, leaders, neighborhood groups that are opposing any form of affordable housing, workforce housing, God forbid, a homeless shelter in their community. And we're creating some relief through a waiver so that they cannot abuse the what we call CEQA process in this state. And so we're looking to advance that bill. It's a quote-unquote trailer bill in our budget, but that also has to be a component of this. We need to get serious about the housing and homelessness crisis. They're connected. The affordability crisis, that is a big part of the reason why so many people are out in the streets and sidewalks. We want to preserve and we want to prevent evictions, meaning preserve existing housing stock, prevent evictions by supporting tenants. I'm working to see if we can get some legislation done this year as it relates to rent gouging. At the same time, we got to increase our production exponentially, but we need to streamline our environmental laws. We need to encourage communities to be part of the solution and not push it off to folks in Santa Monica and say it's just your problem, it's not our problem here in, you know, fill in the blank, one of another community that just wants to push it to some other problem, other jurisdiction to make it their problem.
We're talking with Governor Gavin Newsom about the housing and homeless crisis here in California and his prescriptives for that. SB 50, we talked about the last time that you were with us, and you expressed support for the idea behind it, what the aims of the bill were. You acknowledged that there were some concerns about local communities and what the effect might be with development in those communities. Did you attempt to come in and to keep SB 50 going before it was killed in committee by State Senator Portantino, or did you feel like it needed to be reworked? What did you think of it as it died last week?
Well, we've been encouraging it all the way along. I've been in close contact with its sponsor, Scott Wiener, before it was SB 50, when it was SB 827, which failed last year. So look, this is not novel. This is not new. This is a struggle. You saw comments and quotes from other state senators that vehemently oppose it because they argue one size, quote unquote, does not fit all. It was never going to be an easy lift, but we're not done. This is now a two-year bill. There's other things that we may be able to achieve in the budget. By the way, my budget includes an historic amount of money to support tax credits and loans for housing production and construction, infrastructure related to water, sewage, lighting, and sidewalks, which are a big part, the impediments, enhanced infrastructure financing districts, new opportunity zone tax conformity to encourage affordable housing. There's a myriad of issues in addition to SB 50, but we're by no stretch of the imagination giving up on core tenets of it, and I'm trying to find other mechanisms and means to which we can advance it.
Our conversation right now, Governor, is sandwiched in the middle of a conversation we're having about progressivism as it relates to housing matters. Today's New York Times, a frequent guest who joins us, Farhad Manju, wrote a piece about how it's inconsistent and hypocritical for progressives to not support the development of highly dense urban areas, that really is the future, that is the ideals of progressivism environmentally, economically, and that the people who fought back against SB 50, who might live in single family neighborhoods or the like, that they're, if they're progressive, as many are in California, are inconsistent in fighting that. Where do you come down on that notion?
He's absolutely right. Period. Full stop. I mean, look, I've been, as a former mayor, we've been focused on density bonuses and around transit corridors, walkable, livable cities. I've been trying to connect the whole narrative around transportation and housing, and then extend that to the job, housing, transportation, linkages. It's about quality of life. It's about addressing congestion, the time people are stuck in their cars trying to commute to work, the inability for businesses to even get employees because they have to travel so far, long distances to come to work. This is serious stuff. And look, it's going to require a different kind of political paradigm, different kind of political will. And it can't happen overnight. Look, this has been 40 years. I today gave a speech at the California Chamber of Commerce where I presented them the 1991 front page piece of Time magazine saying, you know, California dreams in peril, housing crisis, issues of droughts and wildfires. None of this is novel, but it's been 30-year trend lines that are now glaring headlines. And so we have to have a different resolve, different approach. And I agree with that paradigm of progressivism. I mean, if you care about the environment, you care about density. If you care about congestion in relationship to clean air and clean, and providing, a cleaner environment, then you care about density. And we're all going to have to give a little if this state is going to thrive, let alone survive. The California dream's in real peril here. The middle class is being squeezed. Kids can't afford to leave their homes. Parents don't even want their 30-year-olds to leave the homes because they may leave the state. I don't want to be hyperbolic, but that article, I read it this morning. It was sent to me by a dozen friends. I thought was spot on.
Governor, thank you as always. Appreciate your joining us and talking about your initiatives on homelessness and mental health. We appreciate it.
Grateful. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Governor Gavin Newsom with us on Air Talk. And as I mentioned, we're going to return to that conversation that we were having that was launched by Farhad's op-ed in today's New York Times. And we're taking your calls at 866-893-KPECC. What do you think of the premise as I just laid it out there for Governor Newsom? 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Back after a live update from Hedy Lynn. Governor Gavin Newsom, just with us on Air Talk, saying he's in agreement with the op-ed piece in today's New York Times by contributor to the paper, Farhad Manju. Farhad's a frequent guest with us on Air Talk. His piece argues that cities have become unlivable because of the hypocrisy of progressives who hold to progressive values in some cases, but as he puts it, are hypocritical when it comes to higher density development. They don't want to give up their single family neighborhoods. They don't want to create what he sees as the real America, which are urban areas, which are higher density, more environmentally conscious, as he puts it, and also more equitable. What do you think about that? We're at 866-893-KPECC. Shirley in Koreatown says, having just listened to Governor Newsom, I've been living in L.A. for 40 years. It was a beautiful city with affordable housing. If he's supporting SB 50, he should put his money where his mouth is, move out of his house and into an apartment. That's Shirley in Koreatown. 866-893-KPECC. Nina in Santa Barbara says, I was born in Brooklyn. When I was a child, it was a beautiful borough. In my 20s, it got scary. Lots of drugs. I left, haven't been back. Now my son lives there. I visited. I see a bunch of young white kids who make a lot of money, pay high rents. They moved there for diversity. But in doing that, they displaced a lot of diversity. They didn't mean to, but it happens. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Let me go back to our guest who was with us before. We were speaking with the Governor Paul Ong, Luskin School of Public Affairs at UCLA. First of all, your thoughts about what the governor's talking about with the task force like this. Do you think they're going to be able to make significant headway?
I think he gave some wonderful answers. I agree with most of his points. I admire him trying to tackle these difficult problems. The problem of homelessness, I think we need to address that. We are a long ways away from dealing with homelessness. Certainly the lack of affordable housing is one factor. It's not the only factor, but it is a factor that we need to look at. I think SB 50 is a move forward. I think this program and other programs, other discussions are very important. I think we need to listen to people's fear about the uncertainty of change. I think we do need collectively to think about what is the best for our society as a whole. Certainly, we should pursue our own personal well-being, but that well-being is also connected with our cities. And again, SB 350 is not forcing development. It's making development possible and potential. It's leveling the playing field. Up to this point, I think land use regulations has favored those who are much more privileged. And we need to make the playing field much more level. And I think it's not perfect, but I think it's important a step forward in having a discussion around it, bringing up the issues, bringing up the flaws and so forth is part of developing good policy.
Yeah, I guess the question is, are you changing the quality of life for one, as you use the term, privileged, one group of people that have homes they've invested in versus another group of people which are perhaps even wealthier people to move into the apartment buildings that are built in that same neighborhood. But I appreciate it, Professor Ong. Thank you so much for being with us. UCLA Luskin School of Public Affairs. He also directs UCLA's Center for Neighborhood Knowledge. Joel Kotkin of Chapman University will continue with us. We'll take more of your calls. This all prompted by New York Times op-ed by Farhad Manju, in which he says it's hypocritical for progressives to fight efforts to urbanize more suburban neighborhoods in cities throughout California. We'll be back in just 1 minute. Wonderful to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. I love it when we choose a topic we're going to do for a contained period of time and the phones just explode and so many people want to weigh in on it. In case you just tuned in, we just had Governor Gavin Newsom on the phone talking about housing, and he's folded into a larger conversation about today's New York Times op-ed by Farhad Manjoo, in which he argues that the state of cities across the country, particularly in California, where he's based, is laid at the feet of progressives, who he says are hypocritical about an unwillingness to create a better urban environment by much higher density housing, and that they fought back on initiatives like SB 50 that would have done away in transit corridors with the longstanding zoning that existed for less dense properties. Joel Kotkin, Chapman University Presidential Fellow in Urban Futures, with us. He's also Executive Director of the Houston-based think tank, the Center for Opportunity Urbanism. Let me take another call here, and it's from Nancy in Palm Desert. Nancy, great to have you with us. Your perspective, please.
Well, I have been a small-time landlord for the last 20 years. I have about 35 units, and mostly I rent to working families. And I have to say that over the last several years, it has become so hard to be a landlord that I am getting out of that business. I've had two houses burned down in wildfires. Both of those homes were rentals. My tenants lost those homes, and they are not going to be rebuilt. I used to take vouchers. I no longer take vouchers because they are so complicated. I get literally inches of paperwork on a quarterly basis for every tenant that I take a voucher for. I can't do it anymore. And the progressive agenda has made it way more complicated than it needs to be. And my question for the governor is he going to include a small-time landlord on his commission? Because we are the ones providing housing, and we are the ones who have a bird's-eye vision into what this complicated issue really is all about. And I don't think that's going to happen.
Nancy, I really appreciate your call. Thank you very much. Joel, your thoughts on what Nancy portrays here?
Well, I think she's, you know, talking about some real problems that are existing. And one of the things I hear over and over again is, as many well-intentioned regulations are put in, but the effects are actually quite negative. And I think this is a pattern. You know, part of the problem is, you know, Governor Newsom, you know, first of all, I can't help but comment that as soon as he had children, he moved to Marin County. So I guess density is good for some, but not for others. But, you know, more to the point, our city's problems are not that they're not dense enough. L.A. is the densest urban region in the United States. And this notion that we're going to create this paradise with transit. Does anyone notice that our transit ridership is going through the floor, that fewer and fewer people take it? We have less, you know, smaller percentage than we did in 1990. So I think, you know, fundamentally what we have to do is deal with the real concerns. And that's why I thought that last call was interesting, because you got to talk to the person who's actually renting buildings or somebody who is providing the housing. And I don't think we spend enough time talking to those people and trying to understand what, you know, what they need, what would help them, what would encourage people to build. Right now, we have a regime where, because of the regulatory regime in large part, the only things that can be built, as Paul and others have said, is expensive, small units that don't really work for families. And in many of the cases, one of your earlier callers, something that I've heard also many times, that we had old L.A. apartments particularly that had a reasonable rents and were good for working-class families being replaced by fancier apartments with smaller units that don't work for families and are very expensive. So I think one of the things the governor should do is sit down with people who are right now on the front lines of trying to provide housing and find out what would affect them one way or the other. I know it probably makes too much sense for them to do it, of course.
All right. Let's see. Let me share some more comments here. Robert in Redondo Beach, I understand you're a landlord. So how would you see a change in zoning to create more apartments in single family neighborhoods?
Well, number one, I encourage anything that will allow for more building. I heard some of the previous callers talk about how many problems they have with renters from middle class families. I rarely have any issues. So anything that can be done to try and create a different type of marketplace to build new units would be very encouraging. Part of the reason you're seeing all of the units being created for the upper class is just simply the amount of money pouring in. A lot of it is used to simply park money for real estate purposes, such as what's going on in downtown and in some of the other areas.
All right. Robert, I appreciate it. Let me share some more comments. Autumn in Long Beach says, I purchased my house at 27 in a historic neighborhood. The whole reason that I purchased the home is because of the charm of the neighborhood. She's concerned about efforts to urbanize much of Southern California by making it higher density, thinks that it would damage that quality of life. Jeff in Mid-City says, I live in an area where they're attempting to build tall buildings next to single-family homes. I'm low-income, but live in a duplex for the lifestyle of that, even though it's a bit more expensive. Developers are just looking to make money here. He doesn't see it as beneficial to make a more dense neighborhood in the area where he lives in. You can share your comments on the AirTalk page, kpcc.org, and keep the conversation going throughout the day. Joel Kotkin, as always a pleasure. Thank you for coming on at quite the last minute and spending an hour with us today.
It was my pleasure, and obviously it's an issue that people are concerned about.
And you'll be writing about in the pages of the SoCal News Group publications and also in Joel's books. It's Air Talk on KPCC. We have a lot more to talk about in the second hour. I don't have time to tell you about it right now, but I will in a couple minutes.